Good afternoon and welcome to the June meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the coast of rainy Maine, and a particularly warm welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord and I'm the head of the forum. Since 1983, we're celebrating our 30th year. More about that later. Lee Webb is in charge of the committee that's going to come out with the festivities for our 30th anniversary. The forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of foreign service, journalism, or academia to talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the U.S. and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and future programs are available on our website, which is midcoastforum.org. Today, the forum is delighted to introduce Professor Dana Frank, who is a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, the author of several books, including Bananeras, Women Transforming the Banana Unions of Latin America, which focuses on Honduras. Her articles have appeared in the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Foreign Affairs, regularly in The Nation magazine. She's been interviewed by NPR and BBC World News, among other broadcast stations. Currently, she's writing a book about the AFL-CIO's Cold War intervention in the Honduran labor movement, while working with members of the United States Congress to address U.S. policy in Honduras. Her topic today is the U.S. and post-coup Honduras, a human rights disaster. So let's give a really good welcome to Dana Frank.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm told, now I have two glasses of water. So where I come from, we're earthquakes, so you would immediately think what will happen to them. You'd know there was a little earthquake. Thank you so much for having me here, and it's really an enormous honor and to be here and speak to you. And thank you for caring about Honduras, my little piece of the world. That it's a great tragedy to have watched it become one of the very worst places in the world in the last 4 years. Not that the starting point was so great. Thank you, Mac, for introduction and all your work. Thanks, Tom DeMarco, who can be here today, for all his work. Thanks, Dick Snyder, for inviting me and showing the lookout and the incredible Maine coastline. And thanks to Sarah Rowe for putting me up and the incredibly gracious hospitality, which was an enormous pleasure, including the birds that I don't, the cardinals whooping it up at 5 in the morning. And I lived in Connecticut for 7 years when I was in graduate school and haven't been back to the area that much. And this is only my second visit to Maine. The first time we drove from New Haven to Mount Katahdin, to someone's cabin for the weekend. So a lot of it was time spent in the car, and it, of course, solidified my desire for a cabin and a lake, neither of which I've achieved ever since, but everyone here. So thank you so much for the opportunity to come to Maine as well. And what I'm going to talk about today is what's happened to the small country of Honduras since the 2009 coup that overthrew the democratically elected president. And I'll talk about the coup, I'll talk about what happened in Honduras, and then I'll pull back to talk about U.S. policy in Honduras, and then I'll talk about congressional criticisms right now and what I think policy alternatives might look like. I don't expect you to have any knowledge of Honduras, part of why this coup was able to go forward, and U.S. policy was able to go forward in the way it did is because there were not a lot of people with a knowledge of Honduras. And so let me just say that it's in Central America, not South America, and it's between Guatemala and Nicaragua with a small border going toward El Salvador, a little piece of the Pacific Ocean as well. If we had a map, you could see that. I think that's the main thing you need to know. So I'll start with the coup itself, and I don't expect you to know anything, and then I'll talk about the resistance to the coup and the support of constitutional order in Honduras and the repression of that, tremendous repression of that movement, and the spiraling downward of human rights and the vast corruption of state security forces, particularly the police, but as well as the military since then, and the breakdown of the rule of law. And then I'll talk about the U.S. role in this and criticisms of that and policy alternatives. And if you want to ask them the questions about John Kerry and what he may or may not be doing differently, the jury is still out on that. Honduras is an obscure country, again, that has become, but nonetheless looms large in U.S. policy in Latin America. It has always mattered strategically to the United States, and we'll come back to. So it's not just I'm choosing to talk about an obscure place, but that it's the first Latin America coup since the 1980s, and it's a big turning point in terms of a return to dangerous times of that we thought were past, and also is now the site of a tremendous remilitarization of the region by the United States. Honduras has 8 million people. It's a very, very poor country. Most of the economy runs on either agriculture, mostly bananas, or export processing zones known as maquiladoras, or remittances from recent migration from the United States. It's been controlled for decades and decades by 13 families that are known as the oligarchs, many of which are of Palestinian Christian descent. They control two parties known as the National Party and the Liberal Party, which are somewhat interchangeable, although the Liberal Party is slightly moves toward the center, but both are far-right parties. And unlike most any other country in Latin America, Honduras has never had an opposition party, so very different from the trajectory in Latin America in the last 20 years in particular, where center-left and left governments have come to power through opposition parties through all sorts of electoral processes. The president at the time of the coup was a man named Manuel Zelaya, Z-E-L-A-Y-A, Zelaya, and he himself came from one of these upper-class families and was very much coming out of the party system. But while he was president, he started developing a social conscience in various ways. And also, this is the time when governments like centrist governments and center-left governments like Kirchner in Argentina, but also left governments like, obviously, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, but all sorts of a range in Chile, Bachelet in Chile, and he started paying attention to his peers in Latin America as well as to what the U.S. was saying. And he recognized Cuba. He raised the minimum wage outside the maquiladora sector. He started developing poverty programs very minimally and recognized Cuba, all of which were threats to the Honduran elites. He also stopped them from a number of even greater power grabs, like the privatization of the ports, some logging laws, a mining law, all of which were very dangerous environmentally. And so he alienated his own party, but did not have a base within the social movements. He himself did not come out of any kind of progressive base in Honduras. But the Honduran elites were very much threatened by this, and they control about 90% of the Honduran economy. That's not controlled by transnational corporations. It has one of the most skewed gaps between rich and poor of anywhere in the world. So part of the base of this is, like, how do you even have democracy and social justice in this kind of context? And it's not like Honduras was great before the coup. There was certainly corruption in the government. In fact, the base of the resistance included a group of prosecutors that had gone out of the hunger strike against corruption in the prosecutors in the Attorney General's office nationally. And also, Honduras had the strongest labor movement in Central America, even though it had the weakest political process for complicated reasons, and a very strong indigenous movement in place as well, and women's movement. The coup itself was on June 28, 2009, which is 4 years ago at the end of this month. And what prompted it was the elites being threatened by Zelaya breaking ranks et al. And they were very much threatened by that. And we can come back to what was the role of the U.S. in this. We don't really know. But Zelaya, as a defensive maneuver against a somewhat, no, he didn't have a base for this, but as a defensive maneuver against attacks from the right, he had the president of Honduras has the right constitutionally to put a public opinion poll on the ballot, known as the fourth ballot. And he put a public opinion poll on the ballot for the day of the coup. He didn't know that was the day of the coup, June 28th, saying, would you like to elect in November, when the regular presidential election was due, would you like to elect delegates to a constitutional convention? That's what it asked. And several countries in South America had constitutional conventions and refounded their constitutions in the previous 15 years and used them to guarantee more indigenous rights, labor rights, and women's rights, and to broaden democracy. So he was doing this sort of as a defensive maneuver. It didn't create a constitutional convention. It just said, there's an opinion poll here. Would you like to do this? So the Honduran far right seized on this and said, Zelaya is using this out of whole cloth. He never said this. He's using this to try to change the constitution so he can have a second term. Okay, so you would have seen that harden into fact in the U.S. newspapers that he was using. They had to have the coup because he was trying to get a second term, and that was unconstitutional. And Zelaya has never made a peep about a second term. Roberto Micheletti, then the president of Congress, the leader of the coup, who became the de facto president for the next 6 months, people dug up 6 weeks later or so that he, in fact, and several other congressmen had signed a letter saying that the Constitution should be changed so the president should have a second term, and he had done that in the 1980s. So in terms of that, this was the reason for the whole thing. So the army refused to distribute the ballots, and there was a constitutional crisis. There's no... leading up to that day of the election, and and there were other elections and the public opinion poll, and he told them they had to do it, and there's no impeachment clause or any procedures. So the morning of the coup, much to everyone's surprise, the military surrounded his house and packed him very famously off in his pajamas at 5 in the morning on a plane to Costa Rica, and also deported the foreign minister to Mexico on a different plane. The plane did stop at Sotocano Air Force Base, the U.S. Air Force Base, on the way. So that led to this new government, which with the full collusion of the entire Supreme Court, which had been picked by the legislature, handpicked to support this in April. So it's the majority of the Congress, but not all, but both parties, and the Supreme Court and the military all fully colluded in this extremely unconstitutional military coup. And even the U.S. ambassador Hugo Lorenz at the time wrote in, you can see this in the WikiLeaks, said there's no question this is an unconstitutional, illegal coup. And I'll come back to that because Obama knew that at the time. So it was a huge surprise. And the other surprise was, and also this obviously a huge rupture of constitutional order. And Latin Americans have fought so hard for constitutional order, as we know, and there has not been this kind of coup in a long time. What the great surprise was the huge resistance that rose up to the coup, a broad spectrum of Honduran society. The labor movement, the women's movement, the indigenous movement, the gay movement, much to everyone's astonishment, all in a big coalition that also included a huge swath of the middle class and some of the elites, the super elites themselves, people that the press would call these Zelaya supporters, but actually some of these people were the Zelaya half or more of the Liberal Party that could still support a Zelaya, but also he was the symbol of constitutional order. So all sorts of people I know that were like criticizing Zelaya up and down all day, every day, suddenly he was the heroic, was sort of shocking. He became the heroic symbol of constitutional order. And imagine if this happened here and you were quite critical of whoever your president of choice that you were critical of, and your choice or not, and suddenly the military overthrew it, they would become a symbol of constitutional order for you and everything would change. And people immediately poured out into the streets by the hundreds of thousands, and we're talking about 500 to a million, 1,000 to a million people. In some of these demonstrations, teachers, I went to a march the first anniversary of the coup, and it was astonishing to me that it was like teachers and lawyers, as union people, you name it, were in these demonstrations, along with people from the campesino or small farmer movement. And it was a huge surprise and really changed Honduras society, because Honduras had never had this kind of mass social movement, and they had a democratic structure of something that became called the National Front of Popular Resistance that had a whole representational system. It still does officially, but it was really in place for about 2 years, and people tried to figure out what to do. What do you actually do to stop this? And it led to tremendous, tremendous repression by the police and the military, and that has not stopped other since. Use of tear gas as a lethal weapon, assassinations, killing by snipers, beatings, rapes by the police, repeated rapes of the same woman by the police, that one woman who was kidnapped by the police demonstration and gang rape and testified about it and was raped again along with her sister. Tremendous death threats and tremendous repression of the media, because the oligarchs control all five. There were four daily newspapers and one online one. One of those papers stayed neutral, to its credit. The television and radio stations are almost completely controlled and by the oligarchs, and so just total lies in the media, which we all understand lies in the media, but this is like bald lies that Hugo Chavez has 20,000 or 10,000 troops on the border and is about to invade, this kind of thing, which led to a tremendous amount of critical thinking about the media. The alternative radio is what came through, particularly a Jesuit-owned station near San Pedro Sula, the big city on the north coast, and a privately owned station in the capital, and they were in turn repressed by the military and the police and had their transmitters trashed and all kinds of repression. So the media freedom issues still go on. Journalists, particularly local journalists that are critical of local power structures, continue to be assassinated regularly. But this tremendous culture of resistance developed. There have been at least 209 documented political assassinations since the coup, and I'm using conservative figures. At least 146 that have been killed, documented to have been killed by state security forces. And just by 2011 alone, over 10,000 complaints of human rights violations by state security forces. And that's the government's own figure, and that's just by 2011. There's almost complete impunity now in the justice system. So one of the things that the coup did is it just, because the coup itself was a total violation of the rule of law, it led, and the people that were then appointed to run the government, and I'll talk about that, then become, just open the doors to near complete corruption. So there's only about 2% prosecution rate for crimes, which means almost complete impunity, which means you get mad at your neighbor, and this happened, a friend of mine's daughter was killed this way. The ex-boyfriend came back with a gun. The housemate's ex-boyfriend came back from the gun, killed the daughter and the son-in-law, and the baby was protected, but she held the baby underneath her, and they were all killed, and but police don't even show up. There's almost no functioning judicial system. The police themselves have then since been, although they were not clean before, have spiraled into tremendous links to organized crime and drug trafficking and lawlessness. Most famously, and I'm sorry, this is such a horrible story, and it's very much a heartbreak. In October of 2011, a woman named Julieta Castellanos, who is the rector or the president of the big national university, her son and his friend of his were driving home at night, and they passed through a police checkpoint and were shot at by the police, who then chased them and killed the son and his friend. And then they realized who they had, and they drove through a series of at least 4 police checkpoints with the dead bodies and dumped the bodies. And the bodies were found, and a big scandal erupted about the police having killed the rector's son and his friend. The government itself admitted that at least 104 police officers up at high levels were complicit in the killing and the cover-up. And that led to a huge snowballing scandal and people speaking out about the corruption, the post-coup corruption of the police. And one of the most famous people that spoke up was a guy named Alfredo Landaverde, who was a former congressman, very well-known former police inspector, who said he had documents showing the police corruption at the very top levels, and he was assassinated about 2 weeks later after that, on the anniversary of the death of his predecessor, who he was accusing the police of having killed. That, in turn, has led to the government admitting that there is, in fact, maybe at least as many as half of the police are corrupt. They won't talk about it as much, but the military are also corrupt and involved in organized crime and drug trafficking. But you can't say over here's the government and over here's the corrupt police and state security forces, because these folks are appointed and supervised by the government, of course. And I'll come back to that, because it's very important in terms of U.S. funding and the question of cover-up. So what happened was Zelaya tried to return to the country. I'm going to go back to the coup itself now. He tried to return to the country several times. I don't know if any of you remember. He tried to return on a plane. I watched this for hours on television, Latin American television. He tried to return on a plane a couple weeks after the coup, and the army put a transport truck, right on the cross, the tarmac, right as the plane was about to land. And he had to take off again. He tried to come back by land, and he was blocked. And eventually, he surfaced in the Brazilian embassy, and the plan was that there would be a popular uprising by surprise, and he would be restored to the presidency. This was September after the coup. The coup was in June. And that plan didn't work, and he ended up being held captive by the government, which was pouring tear gas into the Brazilian embassy for a while. There were about 50 or 60 other people in there with him. And a very terrifying situation. And what happened is that the regularly scheduled elections were, by this point, looming in November. So here, at this point, the U.S. stepped in, and I'll come back to this, but the U.S. never called it a military coup, they called it a coup. Obama would call it a coup, but never used the term military. And if you use the term military, legally, you have to suspend the aid, police and military aid, and some of the other aid as well. And so it was very careful, never say military coup. And Obama never condemned the repression, ever. But talked about Zelaya as if he was a bad child for trying to return to his own country. And meanwhile, Micheletti, the dictator who came to power, After the coup, who was from Zelaya's own party, who was the president of Congress, was treated by the Obama administration as an equal partner to Zelaya, and they went through months of negotiations, and you may have seen this in the New York Times, and the so-called San Jose Accords that were never put into place. So basically, the State Department was buying time until the elections came along. But meanwhile, anybody who was in the opposition in any way could not run for office without being beaten up. You couldn't go on the radio. You couldn't hand out a leaflet. You couldn't go to a rally without being beaten up. There was an independent candidate for president who conceivably might even have won, named Carlos Ache Reyes, and he had his arm broken by the police very deliberately in a demonstration and was in the hospital for a while. So when the elections are looming in November, as this negotiation process is going on, the candidate of the other right-wing party, the National Party, is a guy named Porfirio Lobo, and he's the current president now. And Lobo is one candidate. The Liberal Party that Zelaya came from is completely discredited because the dictator after the coup comes from that party, and also half that party has gone with Zelaya and the opposition, right? Meanwhile, there was this independent candidate and also a small opposition party of about that had gotten 3 or 4% in the past. So all the liberals that were of the Zelaya camp and anybody who was in the opposition to the coup all boycotted, pulled out of the election. They said, there's no way we can have a free and fair election here, that we can't even put out a light leaflet, we can't speak in public, and the ballots themselves are controlled by the very same army that perpetrated the coup. So imagine if this happened in the United States, what would you do in this situation? Would you participate in that election and legitimate it? The Carter Center, the OA, the Organization of the American States, and the UN all refused to observe the elections. The only election observers were the National Republican Institute, which is U.S.-funded, and some participation for the Democratic Party equivalent of that, but only a little bit. So there was no official international observation of this because no one saw that, except the Republican Party branch, saw this as a legitimate election. And surprise, surprise, Lobo won. And Lobo was inaugurated 4 years ago. And he reappointed the same military figures that had perpetrated the coup. One of them even got to be head of the state-owned telephone company, which he said he would use it for surveillance purposes. That's why he wanted it. And continued to appoint, for example, the foreign minister, who is now the minister of security as of a couple weeks ago, Arturo Corrales, was Micheletti's negotiator for the months after the coup. So he was the de facto president's negotiator. So if you want to talk about criminal behavior and the rule of law, these people themselves are coup perpetrators. And that government itself is now widely acknowledged to have a great number of drug traffickers at the very top. And Marlon Pascua, who's the Secretary of Defense, who's not the worst of them, has talked about the so-called narco jueces, or drug judges, narco prosecutors, narco congressmen who are embedded with the cartels. So when we're thinking about the cleanup, now try to imagine how to get out of this mess. And that government continues to be enthusiastically supported by the United States. There has been a lot of noise made in the last year as the scandal broke about cleanup. And Honduras now has, you may have heard, has the highest murder rate in the world, San Pedro Sula, the second largest city, has the highest murder rate in the world starting a little over a year ago. That means it's more dangerous than Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. So if you just want to, any city that you can imagine dangerous, it's more dangerous in terms of the murder rate, and it's a really terrible tragedy that Honduras has spiraled downward since the coup. The new head of police named a year ago, the chief of police was assassinated, and the national chief of police was implicated, and he was canned, and he also had a role in the worst prison fire in modern history, which was on Valentine's Day a year ago. And you might have seen this in the news, and 360 men and one woman died when the police held back. The prison guards are regular police in Honduras. They held back the firefighters deliberately for a half an hour, and that's part of why so many people burned and died. And no one has ever gone to jail for that. And those are U.S.-funded and trained prison guards, and you can see that in the... In the WikiLeaks, you can see actually the lists of people that were vetted and trained by the U.S., including the prison guards at Comayagua. A year ago in May, a new national chief of police was appointed. His name is Juan Carlos Bonilla, or El Tigre Bonilla, the Tiger Bonilla. And if you look him up on Google Images, you can see what looks like the face of Latin American terror, and it is. He himself was charged and documented leader of death squad killings of gang members between 1998 and 2002. And a woman named Maria Elisa Borjas, who wrote that report, has very bravely came forward. And Associated Press, who has done a terrific job in the last year, and I run a credit them here, of breaking these stories, broke that story a year ago. And as a result of that, the U.S. was forced to withhold funding to El Tigre Bonilla by Congress. It was not the State Department that did that. There's something called the Leahy Act. Anybody ever heard of the Leahy Act? This is an important law to know about. It was passed in 1998. It's named after Patrick Leahy, Senator Patrick Leahy, who I think you all know about, who's been really heroic about Honduras, and I want to credit him. And the Leahy Act says, if a U.S. funded individual commits gross human rights abuses and is not being prosecuted, that all funding needs to be immediately cut. In 2012, it was amended for 2012 to apply to their whole unit. So the money is supposed to be cut to their whole unit. Now that's being debated about how that applies, but because of congressional pressure, the State Department was forced to withhold the money to El Tigre Bonilla, the national head of police. He is still there. The U.S., the ambassador has just had her picture taken with him. The U.S. is completely supporting him. The embassy is completely supporting him on the ground, even though the congressional pressure has forced them to cut the money for Bonilla himself. So we have a big fight going on here that I'll come back to. One of the scary things that's happened is that death squad activity, and I think most of you are familiar with the Contra War and the civil wars in in Central America during the 1980s. And Honduras was used as the U.S. base for the invasion of the Contra War, of the invasion of Nicaragua during the 80s. And while the repression in Honduras was nothing like what happened in Guatemala or El Salvador, and I want to credit that it was not, there were at least 100 people that were disappeared by these political death squads. So this is different than El Tigre Bonilla and the killing of the social cleansing of the gang members, but this was targeting of leftists and opposition figures, and there was a famous group called Battalion 316. So now a series of stories in the Baltimore Sun about Battalion 316. So now a lot of those same figures are resurfacing, and it's really dangerous, and everyone is very alarmed about what's going on there. So meanwhile, the other thing that's really alarming that's going on is that the military is increasingly going into policing in the name of, well, if the police are corrupt, maybe the military should do it. And I've learned a lot since the coup about how dangerous it is for the military to go into policing. They're not trained. They're trained to see people as the enemy and kill them. They're not trained to work with communities to enforce laws. And it's a very dangerous precedent. It's widely and all over the world understood to be dangerous for the military to go into policing. The military themselves, there's all kinds of corruption scandals about the police, the military as well. And last May, the military have been extended into policing by Lobo repeatedly since the coup or since Lobo came into office, and that's a violation of the Honduran Constitution, which says you can only have military and police in an emergency, and that's been going on for 2 years. He just recently extended it into 2014. So some military figures, staffing a checkpoint, a police checkpoint in the Capitol, and this young boy who had never been out alone at night before took the family's motorcycle to go off to meet a girl, 14-year-old boy, late at night, and was scared when he went through a police checkpoint, and the police chased him down in an alley and shot him up and killed him. And then the colonel, who was the leader of it, participated in a cover-up and thanks again to Associated Press that tracked the whole thing down and talked to the family of the boy, but nobody has still gone to jail for that. And that was just a red flag about the dangers of military going into policing. And the police officers, the military, by the way, were trained at what used to be called the School of Americas and at the Naval Postgraduate School by the United States. There's a lot of serious constitutional issues here. Most recently, and also just about 3 weeks ago, three retired military colonels were appointed to top positions in the Ministry of Security and in the police. Two of them, one of them was linked, it was ahead of a top government agency that was dissolved because of its links to Battalion 316 in the 80s. One of them was part of the unit, high-ranking officer in the unit that famously killed a Jesuit priest in the 80s. And the third one has been censured by the United Nations for mercenary activity in Iraq. So this is just 3 weeks ago, and just shows you this creeping militarism, but also who are these military figures. There's also been, you may have seen in the news, an area called the Alwan Valley where small peasant farmers who have been losing land to a biofuels magnate named Miguel Facuse have been trying to stage land recuperations, and this is historically how people get land reform in Latin America. At least 102 of them have been killed, one or two at a time, over the last 3.5 years, and it's a very terrifying situation where there's almost no state. The state security forces are working with this biofuel magnate and his army of 200 hired assassins and security guards with almost no intervention or breaks on that from the national state. Finally, before I go into the opposition and the policy side of this in the U.S., you may have just things you may have seen in the media. The U.S. has been very much more and more committed to, quote unquote, fighting the drug war militarily in Honduras. And as part of that, a year ago on May 11th, DEA, U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration officers flying State Department helicopters working with U.S.-funded Honduran police shot and killed 4 civilians who they alleged were engaged in drug trafficking on a boat in the river in the middle of the night. 2 of those were pregnant women. 1 was a teenage boy, and 4 others were also seriously injured. And really flagging what is the role of the United States military itself in U.S. funding. Now, that was Honduran forces, but also that was DEA agents who subsequently killed 2 other pilots that were drug traffickers. And that has really blown up in the State Department's face. You may have seen that on the articles on that on the cover of the New York Times. And people went down there and interviewed the victims. And there was a big story about it also in the fall in the cover of the New York Times. So what about the opposition, where we are in this story? Zelaya returned to the country 2 years ago in a deal that was brokered by various countries, including Colombia, the United States, and Venezuela. He was allowed to return to the country, the deposed president, in exchange for the readmission of Honduras to the Organization of American States. When he came back, a new political party coming out of the opposition was founded. It's called Libre, L-I-B-R-E, which means free in Spanish, and it stands for Libertad y Refundación, or Liberty and Refoundation, meaning, and that comes out of the support, actually, for a constitutional convention and the notion that the only way that you're going to break the power of the oligarchs and have any redistribution, have any kind of social justice or function state in Honduras is if you really refound it from below. But this party is very interesting because it's the first opposition party in Honduran history, and it's very different than anything in Latin American history. It's not it's not Marxist-Leninist party, love left. It's not based on a charismatic individual, although Mel Zelaya tries to be that. And it's not like Bolivia, where it really came out of the indigenous movement. It's a hybrid with a broad swath of social movements behind it, and also a lot of mainstream folks that came out of the better part of the Liberal Party. Zelaya's wife, Xiomara Castro, you'll hear this name, is running for president, and she won in the primaries in the fall. She's leading in all the polls at about 36%. So this is a tremendous threat to the entrenched elite. It's a tremendous moment in Honduran history. The next candidate down at about 19 or 20% is a total wild card sportscaster with no real party named Salvador Nasrallah. And the two main parties are down at 11, 12, 14%, which shows you how people are really rejecting the traditional parties, but the traditional parties are flipping out about this. And the question is, will Xiomara be allowed to win the elections? And what would happen? Would the military allow that to come to pass? And, of course, the biggest player in this in the United States. So let me just speak last about the role of the U.S. As I said, at the time of the coup, I mean, I think where a lot of us, myself certainly, supported the election of Obama and figured he would be an improvement in terms of Latin American policy. And we were all very caught off guard by his positions at the time of the coup. And I think that, and also because there's so few people that know about Honduras, and I myself went from zero to national Honduras expert in about an hour. And you don't think you're an expert on something until you know every 50,000 times wrong with what the New York Times is saying every day. Then that's a definition of an expert. And it's been, you know, acceding to that role has been a big change, transformation in my life. And I just had a week off of not reading the Honduran newspapers every morning for the first time in 4 years. So it's been, that's a whole other story. So much to our disappointment, Obama did not declare a military coup, even though he clearly had, we now know because of WikiLeaks cables from the embassy, that the ambassador very clearly said it was unconstitutional, a military coup. And they continue to legitimate and support Micheletti, the post-coup dictator. I don't use the word dictator, but say de facto president, and allowed the signal they were going to recognize the results of the election no matter what, and immediately poured more money, has continued to pour more money into Honduran military than it did before the coup. So they suspended some money at the time of the coup, but they have poured more and more money in. There's something you probably haven't heard of, but you should know about, called the Central American Regional Security Initiative. And that's been $500 million in the last 3 years. You don't even really know the total numbers. And that is mostly funding for the majority of that, the statistical majority of that goes to Honduras to shore up the Honduran police and military, who are themselves the criminals in this story and interlaced with the drug traffickers. So in the name of the drug war and security reform, the U.S. is pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into supporting this regime. And even language like supporting this regime, I never talked like this before, but I think this is the way we have to speak of it, unfortunately, under the framework of stopping drug war. Now, what about the drug war on this? Certainly, since the coup, drug trafficking has increased dramatically, but it was definitely there before. And some statistics got pulled out of the hat by the State Department. A year ago in March, Vice President Biden traveled to Honduras and gave a speech supporting the drug war and U.S. military support for the Honduran government. Not coincidentally, about a month after 94 members of Congress said cut all police and military aid, and I'll come back to that. And at the day that Biden arrived in Honduras, the DEA said that 80% of all cocaine from South America passed through Honduras. Now, that statistic is so high and so immediately convenient, because there's a fantastic amount of drug trafficking that goes through Panama and Guatemala. So I feel like the Guatemalans and the Panamanian drug traffickers are being blinded here by that 80% figure. We only have the DEA's word for it, and the DEA has so baldly lied about the killing of the civilians and its role in repression in Honduras that it's very hard to even know the drug trafficking figures. There's certainly an enormous amount of drug trafficking, and it's interlaced with the government and the military. So what does it mean to be funding the government and military that are themselves the drug traffickers? Why has the U.S. continued to support this ongoing coup regime? And that's, of course, the $64,000 question. Some of this is because Honduras was always the U.S.'s traditional base in Central America, its most loyal and some would say captive government. It was used in 1954. I'm happy to say that most of you are old enough to know that the U.S. overthrew a democratically elected government in 1954 in Guatemala, and they did it using Honduras as the base. And right before some of my research is about that period, and right before that, they signed the treaty allowing the U.S. to temporarily use Soto Cano Air Force Base, which used to be called Pomerillo Air Force Base, for U.S. military. And Soto Cano Air Force Base is the only large military base that U.S. can land the big planes between here and South America, except for Guantanamo Bay. And I'm not talking about the prison, I'm talking about the military base in Cuba. So it has a military significance, although what are those big planes for? I mean, who are we fighting, right? Most of the fighting has gone against drug traffickers, and I think you can't address this without really criticizing the larger policy approach of militarized interdiction of drug trafficking, which involves killing a lot of people and repressing a lot of people, but does, in fact, just raises the price of doing business, the price of the risk, which makes it even more lucrative to go into that. The real issue is the demand in the United States. That's the real issue, is that if you want to address this in drug policy, rather than saying pour more money into militarizing this war, that was undeclared war, then let's talk about the really difficult questions about drug policy in the United States. And the governments of Guatemala and Colombia have both come out against the militarized drug war, and briefly El Salvador, but they got kind of squelched by the U.S. But the support for the coup in Honduras was also about pushback against the democratically elected center-left and left government, and even centrist governments that have come to power in Latin America in the last 20 years and spiraled out of the control of traditional U.S. domination of the region. And some people call this the second Latin American independence. And it's a wide range of different governments, but they are not necessarily enthralled to the United States. You go to Brazil, and you'll see quite how independent and economically thriving they have. Their own economic relationships with Europe and with China increasingly, and they are not interested in having the United States tell them what to do or increase or have military presence. In fact, you may know that Correa of Ecuador, and I was just there last week, and I could criticize Correa until the cows come home, But he closed the U.S. military base a couple years ago and said, you can have a base in Ecuador when we can have a base in Miami. And, you know, that gives you a sense of, let's just think about that. Would we want Ecuador to have a base in Miami? The other, you know, in trying to understand this, some of this is just out of control military that just wants toys and wants to keep spending money to keep itself going. A friend of mine discovered about a year ago, and AP reported this in February, there was a bid that went out that then it didn't ever happen, ever went anywhere, for $1.3 billion for military electronics and radar for an undisclosed project in Honduras. $1.3 billion. Now, all the military aid in 1 year expanded is $95 million. Now, imagine the social program in Maine that you could spend $1.3 billion on and say, why would we have this be in a defense bill? Authorization that buried in there and with no accountability in a democratic process. You know, the other looming question is the economic investments of China in Latin America, which are growing and are large. And I heard a very interesting talk by a woman at the Defense University, and I forget what it's called, but a lifelong expert on China and China and the rest of the world. And she said, you know, she studied this very hard, and she was speaking to mostly military people when I was there, but China doesn't operate militarily. They operate economically, and they make economic relations, and they get power that way. And I'm not saying we shouldn't take seriously the power of China all over the world, particularly in Africa, but this is not a military threat to the United States. It's a very different strategy of recognizing sovereignty and building viable economic partnerships and relationships, which is like what I think the United States should do. So let me just end with the pushback against this. I'm sorry to say that Obama's positions have been really scary and terrible on this. He doesn't have the anti-communist rhetoric that Reagan did, but the effect here is the same, and I'm very sorry to have to say that in terms of supporting an ongoing coup regime and not speaking critically about it and being resistant to criticism. You may know there was a so-called constitutional coup in Paraguay a while ago, and the U.S. Recognized the new government immediately that threw out a progressive government. So here's the criticism part, and then I'll just end here. The criticism of Congress has grown dramatically. In the months after the coup, to their credit, John Kerry, who at the time was chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Congressman Howard Berman, who was at the time the ranking Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, put out a letter to Obama saying, call it a military coup, don't recognize this government, and have free and fair elections. And Obama ignored that, obviously. Since then, increasing criticism coming out, particularly out of the House, a series of letters saying that police and military aid should be suspended. The first one had 30, came from my own congressman, Sam Farr, not coincidentally. The second one came from Congressman James McGovern in Massachusetts, and the one a year ago, from Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky of Illinois. 94 members of the House signed it, all Democrats, saying cut the police and military aid immediately because of the human rights crisis and the human rights violations by U.S.-funded state security forces. There was a letter last June sponsored by Congressman Jared Polis and the so-called Equality Caucus about the killing of lesbian, gay, and transgendered people in Honduras. There's been a lot of targeting, killing of gay people in Honduras. So that one had 84 members signed it, included a lot of people that hadn't signed any of our other letters. And one that was started this last fall that circulated in January, signed from Congressman Hank Johnson of Georgia and members of the Congressional Black Caucus about the repression of Afro-Indigenous people and African descent people in Honduras. So, and it's been building a broader and broader base of leadership within the House. And it's, you know, obviously the Republicans control the House, but and also John Conyers, who's chair of ranking Democrat on Judiciary, has been really ferocious about the DEA killings. In the Senate, everyone always says you get one phone call from one senator. That's a really big deal, and that one senator certainly has been Senator Patrick Leahy, who's been fantastic. And also Senator Barbara Mikulski of Maryland, who sponsored a letter in a year ago March about human rights conditions in Honduras, has stopped short of saying cut the aid, but we had seven senators on that one, and that was a really big deal. She is now the big chair of the Appropriations Committee. She's much more powerful. She can't do letters now. Leahy himself, two or three senators put the aid on the money using the Leahy Act, the money for the National Chief of Police, with the State Department kicking and screaming all the way and still supporting Bonilla. And last summer, Leahy put a hold, he has a right to do this, and Leahy is chair of the State Committee on State and Foreign Operations of the Committee on Appropriations, and you may know that Leahy is now the highest-ranking senator. He suspended $50 million of police and military aid last summer, and only $10 million of that is still held. So right now we have a letter circulating from Senator Cardin about human rights issues, and if any of you have any influence over Senator Angus King, please call him and write to him in the next few days and ask him to sign the letter. The deadline is Friday. So, you know, you don't have to agree with what I'm saying, but if you do, please ask him to do it. And we have this deadline trying to get as much show power in the Senate as possible. What do we do instead? I think we should be immediately not recognizing this government. I think certainly we should not be funding it with police and military aid, but in the hundreds of millions. We don't even know how much. People would like to see, the human rights community in Honduras would like to see a commission on impunity with real prosecutions and run by the United Nations. I think the United States has been really discredited in its role here, so we can't see the U.S. stepping in. Their hand-picked commission, which they created a year ago, has supported El Tigre Bonilla very publicly, the death squad leader of the national police. I think we have to ask for protection for all the people that have received death threats, are not getting protection, as people do in Colombia. And I think really, much as I could criticize, again, Libre, the opposition party, till the cows come home, there are really only two possible outcomes in the November election. One is the continuing ruling party, and the guy who's coming up the ranks, the National Party candidate for President Juan Orlando Hernandez, is a terrible and terrifying thug who just overthrew the Supreme Court in December. I haven't even had time to go into that. I can do that in the questions. I think the only way forward is Libre wins in all its messiness and is allowed to take power. That will only happen if the State Department wants to let that happen, because the State Department controls the military, and we know that they are pouring money into candidates, and they have to accept that the only way we cannot have this bloodbath continue is to have some kind of an opposition party come to power. They're centrist. This is not a threatening far left, but we have to allow sovereignty to go forward in Honduras. The ruling parties, the traditional parties, are incapable of doing this. They are just going to pull us deeper and deeper into this. And those of us that care about human rights, and it's been a great tragedy for me, as you can see, to love a country that is so small and in such a terrible situation. And I weep for my own government's role in this. So thank you so much for caring.
Hey, Dana, that's, I hate to say great, it was certainly fascinating, but incredibly tragic. So now we've got time for some questions. Let me see, the first question.
Oh, we have them written down.
We have them written, yeah. That way we can decide to go.
That way you can be anonymous.
It's not that. We can see which are the good ones and which are not.
We can play handwriting analysis.
The first one is, does Obama see a political benefit to his position? What would his reaction to your talk be, you think, if he were here today?
No, this is a really interesting question, and I spent a long time thinking about it. I mean, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what's going on in the State Department to try to speak to them, right? From what I'm told is he under Hillary Clinton, pretty much ceded the State Department to Hillary Clinton himself, okay? And then Hillary Clinton herself, the priorities were the Middle East and Asia. So Latin America was way, 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 way down the list. So she's not even running the show about Latin America. And then Latin America policy was in the hands of first of a guy named Thomas Shannon, who's the ambassador to Brazil, and now William Brownfield, who's the assistant secretary of state for the drug war. They're running the show, and Obama is not paying attention to Latin America. Kerry, I think, does know about this. I know people who used to be on his staff when he was in the Senate. But the cost, you don't win in Latin America. It's like, well, whether Kerry will use up his political capital on Latin America, and particularly Honduras, and they have other issues like Cuba and Venezuela that they're paying, Mexico, that they're obviously paying attention to. So I think Obama isn't even, I wish it was on his radar screen. It's not on his radar screen at all. The question is, how do you even get it onto Kerry's radar screen and get him to care? And of course, that's partly why I'm here and why they know, on the other hand, that the Senate that it's reached a critical mass in the Senate. And long ago in the House. And we have some, at least one Republican, Congressman Frank Wolf of Virginia, who's being great and cares about human rights.
Okay, we've got a couple of questions on American corporations. Are there serious pressures from U.S. corporations to back the post-coup regime? And the other one is, can you talk about the role of U.S. and international corporations in our foreign policy?
This question of the U.S. corporate presence is very interesting, and of course, I would like to know the answer to that. Lurking out there somewhere are Dole and Chiquita, the banana corporations, and they've stayed completely underground. No banana workers have been repressed, and I know them. So I think that Chiquita has probably backed the coup, but has said, don't touch any of the banana workers because it'll blow up internationally because everybody wants to blame everything on Chiquita. Actually, Dole is as big as Chiquita in Honduras. The oil industry is really the hidden player in here that we don't know much about, because one of the things that Zelaya did is he bought oil from Petrocaribe at much lower prices, and that meant that the British and the American oil companies did not get the contracts at the higher prices, right? So they lost a lot of money in that. And the one time I met Zelaya, I asked him about that, and he said, yeah, every time he ever went to another country, the first person that met him in the hotel was somebody from the oil industry. And Lobo himself had just, much to his desire, bought money from oil from Petrocaribe again. So in terms of whether that was, the cause of the coup. So I think the oil companies are in there somewhere big. And then there's the export processing zone interests, the so-called maquiladora sector. They continue to profit from the absolute lack of labor law enforcement. And really, Dave, if you know about Bangladesh, those kinds of conditions, there's about 130,000 of these factory workers in these kinds of conditions in Honduras. They continue to benefit from the lack of labor law enforcement. And then there's telecommunications and banking interests involved in this, too. So in terms of the role of the corporations in U.S. foreign policy, I bet a lot of you know more than I do. I of course would like to see that smoking gun to be able to follow the money, of where the money follows to this. I think that it's so deep inside the concept of what is a good business climate. But also, I think there's defense contractors are in the story, too, in ways that I'm just beginning to unpack. Of really seeing where remembering the military industrial complex and its independent economic interests, which is not the same thing as the wealth that's extracted from the Honduran.
Okay, this is a broader question about U.S. interests, not just the corporate interests in Honduras. Again, we've got a couple of questions on that. Honduras sounds like a failed state. What do you see is the U.S. interests in Honduras? Is it simply the airbase? And the other question is, besides the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and the human rights interests, why should the U.S. care about what mm-hmm. happens to Honduras? Okay. The final question, that maybe the answer is the situation in Honduras such a destabilizing factor in the region that the United States should care about it from that point of view?
Let's just talk about we can come back to what are U.S. interests here, the failed state question, because, there's these failed state theories that I'm new to about, and that sometimes it's described as a failed state. And I heard this lay Catholic worker speak last fall in Philadelphia, and she said, when we talk about the state failed, who is the situation benefiting now? And I want to add to the economic interests, which is there are tremendous mining interests and dam interests that are benefiting from laws that have been passed since the coup, and this is some of the things that Zelaya was passing, that they're extracting a great deal of wealth through the environmental destruction of Honduras and the destruction of indigenous communities as we speak. And also a lot of that is Canadian as well as U.S. mining interests, and this is going all over the region. So some people are, in fact, benefiting from the failed state. The drug war takeover does, in fact, allow the U.S. to pour its own military funding, more, its own military presence, as well as supporting the Honduran military. So many interests are being served by the so-called failed state. So it's not completely failed. And also, I'm uncomfortable with the failed state because it sort of said, it plays into the notion that in the third world, that the little brown people can't govern themselves. And so therefore, the United States should come in as the force, when the United States is, in fact, the force blocking sovereignty and self-government in Latin America, historically, sadly. Then the question is, why should we care? Was that the second one?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Why should we care? Well, first of all, it's our government that has created this problem over the century in the United in Honduras in particular. And I feel I have a moral responsibility for where my tax dollars and what my government does. So that's the most basic thing. I think we have a moral responsibility to stop what's going on there. And my bottom line in everything I do here is, how do I stop people in the human rights community, in the opposition? At least 6 members of Libre and candidates have been assassinated in the last year. The opposition party, I left that out. How do you just keep people alive to fight for social justice and democracy in their own country? And it's our government that's funding these death squads. It's our government that's funding this repression into the hundreds of millions of dollars. So that's why we should care. And then the destabilizing force. So this whole question of what is stability is what is instability. We're not talking about the situation in the 70s or 80s with armed insurrections. There's no armed struggle going on here. We're talking about a popular movement. Some people might throw a rock here and there at a demonstration if they're already being hit by the cops. It's the most I've ever heard of in terms of armed struggle in Honduras. And people die in the armed struggle. They don't want to go there. They understand what happens if you go down that path, and they just don't go there theoretically. So we're talking about, how do you have a path to democracy when so many paths to that are blocked? And so I think that that's what we want to figure out, is how do we have a way of moving there forward, and what would a progressive role for the United States look like? Obama said he wanted to change things, and he hasn't. In fact, he's gone backwards. So how do we have a reset? And I wrote a piece about this in the Los Angeles Times. Mr. Kerry, let's have a reset of U.S. policy. And Howard Berman wrote a stunning letter about this to Hillary Clinton in October, like resetting policy. Like, let's really imagine a progressive policy and what it would look like, and ask for that and settle for nothing less.
Okay, this is about the, again, we got a couple of questions on this, on the U.S.-directed war on drugs. The first points out that at this point, Mexico is challenging our role, the importance of the U.S. War on drugs. Does that mean that Honduras has now become the center of our war on drugs program? And the broader question is, what impact is the United States war on drugs having on Central America overall, not just Honduras?
Yeah. Again, Mexico, which has this tremendous strategy of Mexico, of the militarized drug war, which just leads to more and more killing. And so there's a tremendous peace movement and movement against violence from the grassroots all over the place. It's a very beautiful thing that's building of the families of the victims in Mexico. So, again, where is the U.S. casting about for its allies in this failing approach? And again, Honduras was always its traditional base in the region. So they're pouring more and more money into it. But it's a regional question, because the Central American region, the drug issue is all throughout the whole region, and it's certainly an issue in El Salvador and in Guatemala and Panama in particular. And a lot of these issues, like the exploitative mining, the repression, certain kinds of repression, situation in Guatemala, you may know. Somebody who was implicated in the genocide of the 80s is the current president. He's implicated in the recent conviction that got overturned of the former president. And it's a lot of these are very regional issues about U.S. military expansion and support for repression regime, but there's some serious exceptions to that. I mean, much as I might be very critical of Daniel Ortega and the current Sandinista government, they have addressed issues about some issues about wealth and poverty in Nicaragua, and El Salvador's government, centrist government, center-left government, has been trying to establish independence. So there's a big, very mixed bag, as opposed to the very repressive government of Panama and Guatemala. In Costa Rica, the U.S. is very much pressuring. You may know that Costa Rica famously does not have a military, and the U.S. is really, really putting the pressure on very rapidly to militarize Costa Rica, and we should be alarmed about that as well, because it's been the one shining light.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And they're starting to give in, I should say.
Yeah, since you're talking about the military, we got a couple of questions about the military. What role does the U.S. Southern Command play in Honduras, and are there U.S. military actually stationed and functioning in Honduras?
Yeah. So there is the definition of the U.S. military. There are about 600 to 800 soldiers stationed at Sotocano Air Force Base. Under the Honduran Constitution, that's supposed to be temporary, okay, since 1954, and they've been there ever since. And they, one of the things that happened after the coup with the U.S. military expansion in Honduras was the U.S. put out a $50 million contract to make the barracks at Sotocano permanent. And that they've since been made, but that was 2 years ago, and that is a total violation of the Honduran Constitution. There might be some treaty that nobody knows about, but as far as we can tell. So that's been made more permanent. Then there's the DEA. We don't really know whether the DEA troops are still in there. And the Marines have been in there once or twice about various things. So there's also, and then there's sort of goodwill projects where the U.S. Army comes in. I read every Google News story every day, and you see they go and build a school to show goodwill for the U.S. military. The Southern Command is now under a guy named William Kelly. And the Southern Command is the U.S. military unit that's separate from the U.S. South. And the Southern Command is, you know, he very much is supportive of this, but he's some people that I meet with are talking with him about it, and he's, I think he's interested in the criticism that are coming from the Senate, because there's some people that he knows in the Senate that actually, a senator that I'm meeting with this week that is friends with him and is talking to him about it. I mean, we'd like to see the military. I mean, I'm trying to learn about the military in this, and I think he is a conservative and is supportive of these general policies, but is capable of listening to input. So we hope that there's some opening there.
Before you go, we want to give you, you know, I'm sure you've heard about it.
I thought it was going to be silver.
The silver one didn't arrive yet.
that was the other speaker.
The famous Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations,
yay,
mug. And please take it with you on your next trip to Honduras.
I wouldn't want to have it to it. Too much crime. Thank you so much. Thank you.